We generous. Long past midnight, hard rain. Somewhere 20-30 blocks west the downtown Chicago grid, in a neighborhood taxis don't come to or stop in this late, in search of the sublime, gawkers at the Velvet Lounge, soul hole wedged alongside Fitzy's famous, fresh out of two epic sets, avant-garde, jazz played wildly but seriously by a cabal of young lions gathered round their graybeard leader, saturated down through our jackets, laughing about it, falling into a kind of sad sack parody of a gang's strut. I want to say, a bunch of white guys, but that's not exactly it. Comrades, then, ecstatic encounterers of rain-slick streets, eager to inhabit this one particular moment, whole-souled and sad. Can you picture it, hovering there at the outer rim of the inner circle of regulars clustered at the bar? We're hip enough to recognize, when the bartender puts him on, Tatum, his slalom runs and storm-pitch arpeggios a kind of sped-up Bud Powell, hip enough to order drinks wiped clean of class to clap in the right places, though it ain't easy anticipating the step-back pause inside the baritone's circular breathing, chords spraying from a hock-shop horn, leg propped on the stage like a trapdoor hinge, one song bleeds into the next, drummers switching mid-bridge, and a flute player sitting in, only white guy on stage who screams into his flute an extended riff on the absence of beauty, bass pulsing triple time, clanging like at a railroad crossing, horns knocking together like boxcars. Remember that little lunch place on Franklin? We stepped out into that L.A. oven to find Peter's little VW bookended by cop cars. Bad omen, I said. I choose, Peter said, to see it as they're looking out for my best interest, which I assume he meant spiritually a black man's sarcastic prayer against indirect malice. You read a poem that night about being called nigger by a white man with a bar stool for a handshake, how at great cost you beat him into submission. The lone black man in the audience coming up to shake your hand, saying he could relate. Later, in Leimert Park, it's me who has the bullseyes on his chest. You leaned in to remark on vertigo, how it overtakes you when you're out of your element. Elvis on the lunch joint radio, you gave me this look that dropped on the counter, heavy into the cup of your hands. I saw you trying but failing to inhabit the world in a manner akin to prayer. Let's not forget this country has always enjoyed its minstrel show, even better when the blackface is invisible, and the man shimmying on stage isn't that hit parade of soul, but some country white boy with hips like a girl's and soulful eyes any mom'd melt for. I kept drifting, following the bird's choppy path through sun-gutted windows. They seemed first to fly through a fence, then morph into schooling fish shivering in a landscape of blue. There was this movie you stayed up late for, ringing your mind's backdoor bell. In it, this white-collar guy dreams he finds God crouched in a dingy closet in a building at the heart of a city on fire, Dresden or Los Angeles, and though he has the head of a lion, God is scared. The man must take his hand to reassure him. We catch the last train when the rain refuses to stop playing. This kid in a Bulls jersey, no more than 14, starts right in. He sneers, "You Irish?" Then, "You white folks are crazy." Then, with a comic's timing, "Get me a fucking job." There's anger there, but bluff's mostly what I see. Too tired to harass him back or move to another seat, I merely smile. It's a calm resignation cities bring. The next morning the storm will sweep through, leaving the streets wet, schoolgirls trundling by in full dress, beat on our way for coffee, hangovers pulled down like soggy hats, will be accosted by a Girl Scout who shouts, "You know you want it." We laugh. We do and we don't. Maybe our fight is not to be awake. We're resurrected all the time by fire, but to stay that way. The familiar rocking of the subway carrying us into the next station of night. When did the conversation swerve to the morning's headline slap? Policeman guns down unarmed black man. Same old shit, Peter muttered. I conjured up the image of a madman taking us out, carnival cutouts, knocked down, blam, 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 with three twitchy trigger pulls. You remarked, "Man, that's just your white man's guilt urge to go down in flames." You were right. Heading back down 10 the night before in that low-slung sports car Coltrane in place of the rap blasted on the way out, I started to say, "I like my anger beautiful," but knew it was a matter up for discussion, and so let the night's bad breath wash us raw. The freeway crowded at midnight, lights of the inland valley sequencing the night. I thought you'd fallen asleep. You were just taking train in through your pores. Let me tell you a story about Art Pepper, fresh out of jail. He's between everything. Gigs, fixes, horns. Diane arranges a gig, not telling Art, so he wakes up to the news. He's playing with Miles' rhythm section. Philly Joe, Garland, Chambers on bass. He's afraid, of course. Hasn't touched his horn in months. Cork stuck in its neck and taped in place. Mad at Diane. In awe. They've been playing with Miles, their masters. He'd been goofing. Fixing big before, forgets every song in the book. So, Gentleman Red says, "I know a nice tune. Do you know this?" And Art plays it beautiful, chasing after the melody of "You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To." Let's Red call the songs rest of the way. "What should I do at the end?" "Just do a little tag kind of thing." And Art does. They get 8 songs on tape. After, she gives him a look that asks, "Happy?" "Yeah, he's happy." Worried, too, he's not played well enough. And proud, bragging up his genius like a cocky boy. The night he falls back into dope, 6 months clean, he tells Diane, "You have to know someone loves you. When you do, everything is easier." Mr. Rhetorical, I once asked you, what is it about this country that makes it hard even to be friends? You could only shake your head. Sitting in the back of Peter's car, Marvin Gaye's "What's Going on the deck," I listen to you both articulate your impatience with our sorry state of affairs, unsure if I was part of the solution or piling more wood under the fire. Memory's clumsy, so much left out, so many subtle add-ins. Coming out of an underpass, I spied a billboard that for a second read, "We Generous," before blinking and seeing what the words actually said. "We've got to find a way," Marvin crooned, "to bring some lovin' here today." But how? What we, and how generous. There was something about that crowded table of young musicians, in between sets, cordoned off by invisible rope, that haunts me. Is it that they didn't look over once all night? That's not it. Any circle worth its form curls inward, a spring about to unfurl in a snap. It's too loud to talk, anyway. Two brotherhoods convening for a night. Can you even call such proximity a meeting? The way a man and a woman share a smoke outside a club, not knowing what to do with the plenitude of loneliness, except refrain from offering some of its sweetness to one another. Somewhere dead center, inside the second set, I am ready to scream or get the hell out, to pace the album cover street, wrapped in drizzle, yearning for something to breathe my sweet blue self back into. But then David leans in, mouth at my ear. Why does sabotage always answer its own urgent question by blowing things up? I shout my retort, there's no melody in the world worth this much chasing. But at the last possible moment, the baritone grabs hold of funky R&B riff and rides its steamboat current to the night's horizon, bobbing lovingly in its wake, taking all of us left in the place right along with him. And I see the woman behind the bar allow the rhythm carry her into the groove of her habitual chores, as the man on his way to the John falls easily into its rutted sway.